Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy, and this week we're asking, can America maintain its position as the world's greatest economic power? By many measures, the American economy is powering ahead. GDP is on track to grow at around 3% this year, and the unemployment rate is an impressively low 3.7%. It's an unmissable opportunity for President Trump to describe the economy as so good, perhaps the best, he said, in our country's history. But for others, the same figures present an economic puzzle. My guests today are the authors of a new book called, ambitiously, Capitalism in America, A History. Dr. Alan Greenspan was first appointed by President Reagan as chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve and presided in that role for nearly 20 years, at the helm in an age of turbulence. Was he an optimistic believer in market efficiency, failing to pop bubbles in the late 1990s or mid-2000s? Or was he, as one biographer recently put it, the man who knew? As chair of the Federal Reserve, he's well-versed in giving guarded comments. His every word could move markets, like his description of irrational exuberance, which sent markets south in 1996, well before the dot-com bubble finally burst in 2000. Dr. Greenspan, welcome to The Economist Asks, and we hope you feel candid with us today.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
His co-author is the very free-talking journalist, Adrian Wooldridge, formerly our American Bureau Chief and Lexington and Schumpeter columnist, now our Badgett, British political columnist. Adrian, thank you too for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Greenspan, you start the book by imagining the World Economic Forum, that grand gathering in Davos, in 1620. And all the countries of the world are jostling for dominance. America, however, doesn't feature. So how did it become the world's biggest economy?
Well, that's the extraordinary story which we try to present in the book. In other words, that's where we started. And we are where we are today, for good or ill, but the whole substance of the book is a conceptual approach to what forces were at play, which got us from there to here.
And what are the forces that you think that drives America forward when we look at that grand sweep of history?
Well, basically, what has characterized the United States through most of our history, is that we were helped by the Constitution of the United States. It set property rights and various other relationships, which created the optimum climate for economic growth. And there's no question that were we to back off from that, that we'd start to become an average economy.
Adrian Wooldridge, do you read it similarly?
Well, absolutely. I think that the central argument of the book is that economic growth is driven by what Joseph Schumpeter called in 1942 creative destruction. It's the willingness to move from old established ways of doing things to new innovative ways of doing things. And we argue in the book that America has been unusual in its willingness to embrace creative destruction. What are the reasons why America has been so willing? I think partly because it's such a big country and that it can afford to move from the old to the new in ways in which small countries are much more nervous. It's partly because it's a new country. America was founded in roughly the same year that Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations. Most countries are old countries with old established ways of doing things. America America wasn't really. It was created in the world of growth and in the world of business. And so it was dynamic in that sense. It had a uniquely entrepreneurial culture, a uniquely entrepreneurial approach to business. Lots of immigrants, lots of room to move, lots of economic resources. So it's a very dynamic culture. But as Dr. Greenspan said, it was a dynamic culture with one fixed point, and that fixed point is the Constitution. The Constitution defines a set of rights. It divides power. It creates a sort of framework which provides stability amongst all the dynamism. So it's this unique combination of dynamism and the stability, certainty provided by the Constitution, which I think explains a lot of America's greatness.
Yes, Dr. Greenspan, what are you going to choose from this very rich period? And even that is quite a long era that Adrian has covered in that sentence. What are you going to choose then from this beyond the sort of foundational time as the decisive moments, put it bluntly, make America rich?
Well, it's the post-Civil War period which we're talking about. Civil War was a devastating period for the United States. And without its obvious consequences with slavery. What the post-Civil War period was an extraordinary period of economic growth, basically characterized by the ability to take an industrial environment and reduce the amount of input you required to get the same output. Henry Bessemer in the 1850s came up with a wholly new way of producing steel, and the steel industry became a dominant force in the second half of the 19th century in the United States, and in fact created Andrew Carnegie, who ultimately put together the pieces of what became U.S. Steel. But then as the years went on, and we ran into Henry Ford and the development of motor vehicles for the average person, this accelerated the whole development. And it's historically unprecedented in any other country in the world.
The United States both had an extraordinary capacity to bring in immigrants from abroad with extreme entrepreneurial skills, but also to adapt ideas from the rest of the world and apply them at scale. And the sort of scale of something like Carnegie Steel is unparalleled in Britain. Britain is the biggest producer of steel in the 1850s, and then by 1900 is absolutely dwarfed by, I think, Carnegie Steel on its own is producing more than the whole of the United Kingdom. So America really takes the lead in the world from Great Britain in that 50-year span.
And seeing as you mentioned, both of you have touched on Andrew Carnegie, what about the robber barons and their reputation, amassing immense wealth, obviously building businesses which were world-beating, but their reputation, and particularly at a time when we look at the gaps in wealth and at the super-rich with perhaps more scepticism than we did, the robber barons have a lot to answer for.
I mean, the robber barons are amassing huge fortunes. And it's often said in their defense that they may have amassed these great fortunes, but at least they gave some of the money away in philanthropy. And it's wonderful, these philanthropies they created. But I think the much more important thing that they did was to reduce enormously the cost of inputs into the economy. So if you're reducing the cost of steel and you're reducing the cost of oil, you're actually ultimately making everybody much richer. And what they're reducing those costs because they're developing organizations, ways of running the steel industry, ways of running the oil industry, which are simply much, much, much more efficient. And they're driving their competitors out of business, not because they're cheating, but because they're just better at doing what they're doing. And there's a very interesting comparison, I think, between the robber barons of the 19th century and today's silicon giants. And it's an extraordinary comparison because the similarities between the two
silicon
groups. between the Silicon Valley and the robber baron world are quite astonishing. You have huge companies being created very, very quickly. You have entrepreneurs basically masterminding the creation of these companies. And you have fundamental economic inputs in the 19th century, steel and oil, today information, being rendered much, much cheaper for everybody. And I think that this points to two remarkable things about America, which helps to explain why America has become the great economic giant that it has. One is America is just really good at producing entrepreneurs. These are people who are capable of taking industries and revolutionizing them and have absolutely gigantic ambitions. And secondly, America is incredibly good at creating companies, startups that can become giants very, very quickly.
Dr. Greenspan, where do we think that the sad story of slavery fits in this picture? How does it affect the engines of capitalism?
Well, it's not the engines of capitalism, it's the Constitution. Slavery is an abomination. I mean, you can't have in the basic statement of the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. Well, that redefines who is a man and who is not. And I think that we've been dealing with and what slavery actually did was, as if it had continued going, was essentially create an impossible situation, which meant the Civil War was inevitable. I've always argued that it was the cotton gin, which was invented in 1793, which took the cost of so-called upland cotton down very significantly. So when the issue arose with the cotton gin and production increased an extraordinary amount of so-called short staple cotton, we had a very high demand for slavery.
So what's happening here, Anne, is that slavery is in some ways becoming outmoded insofar as it's ever moded. It's becoming people like Jefferson and Washington, who were slave owners, are beginning to free their slaves. And also the British Empire, of course, abolishes slavery in 1833, I think. And so slavery is beginning to look backward-looking. And then something remarkable happens, which is this technological innovation with the cotton gin makes slavery economically vital again. So you see slavery declining in the late 18th and early 19th century. Then it begins to take off again and spread across the United States because this technological innovation makes it more economically useful, profitable.
Now, some of our listeners will be familiar with the kind of experience where you go and you see all of Shakespeare plays very truncated in one short performance. So I'm going to have to move you two gentlemen along, perhaps through history a little bit faster than might seem comfortable. If I were to ask you, do our homework for us, why did the Great Depression happen? What would you say?
Well, I think it goes back to World War One. One of the things that occurred as a consequence, as you well know, is that when the war was over, Britain and all other European countries tried to reset their currencies against the United States dollar, which existed pre-war. And as a result, there was a huge distortion in the whole structure of economic forces. And that is often discussed as the reason why Hitler arose and why all of the extraordinary things that occurred to lead us essentially to World War II, which is really an extension of World War I, because World War I never resolved the problems that had existed that caused it.
Adrian.
Well, I mean, a hard question, but one of the oddest things about the Great Depression is that there are in some ways two depressions or two recessions. There's one at the beginning of the 1930s, and then America begins to get out of the recession, partly because of the New Deal in the mid-1930s. But then towards the end of the 1930s, it goes back into recession. Unemployment starts going back up. You get this serious crisis of the economy yet again in the late 1930s. And the only thing that really pulls America out of the depression, I think, is the Second World War, which massively stimulates demand.
But perversely, this sounds like the answer to these problems is war. I mean, it's almost like the kind of, you know, the sort of Bertolt Brecht view of capitalism. It's driven by war and the war machines drive the wealth. I mean, why is that wrong?
Well, basically because what it guided was aircraft and ships. People cannot have bread on the table as a consequence of improvement in aircraft and ships. It's merely the mechanism and the awareness, for example, that you went to a so-called cost-plus system, that there's no better way to get the private sector to function than a cost-plus system. But I think that's going a bit too far. I don't think it's in the spirit of what a free market economy is.
I'm going to ask you both to step back perhaps and look at that question about the Depression and what we learn from it when we come to dealing with the financial crash of 2008. Dr. Greenstone, what did you learn about that arc of history?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's a bubble bursting. Bubbles are the result of human, I don't know if it's psychology or what it is, but there are flawed aspects to human nature, one of which it produces bubbles because of a degree of euphoria which irrationally evolves and eventually collapses. It looked, for example, that when the crash occurred in 2008, it was actually far more virulent in a collapsing of the financial system than in 1929. I mean, in 1929, you still have very, say, the coal money market still existed, and it had 20-25% interest rates. But in 2008, the market disappeared. There were no bids. There were nobody willing to back up a number of the markets, and the system imploded very significantly. And it wasn't until we had the actual evidence that what happened there granted the nature of human beings, how they behave with uncertainty and the like. And this is the area, incidentally, in which behavioral, so-called behavioral economics, has delved very deeply. In any event, you have to do two things to produce the 1929 and the 2008 crisis. One, you need a toxic asset. And the toxic asset in 1929 was stocks. And in the 2008, it was mortgages. But you also need, as a necessary condition, that these toxic assets are also basically leveraged. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that appeared in both 1929 and 2008 was a high degree of leverage. So I've concluded now, we now understand the way these things arise based on the two major examples.
So we've learned an enormous amount from these two examples. Yeah, we actually
absolutely
can base a real theory of how to prevent future crises on two huge examples.
There are a lot of data that fits directly into that context.
When people say to you, Dr. Greenspan, you presided over an enormous credit bubble, what was the central flaw in your thinking that you discern when you look back on that?
Well, I had the impression that what, on the observations that I had made up to that date, was that bankers and financiers generally would tend to look after their own self-interest in a manner adequate to create a rebalancing. But it was very clear, especially at the top of the 2008 boom, that everyone was waiting for it to crash. But as the chairman of Citigroup said, so long as the music is playing, we have to dance. When it stops, we won't. But the reason they did that is if they didn't quote, dance, close quote, they would have lost market share. So there's a very interesting set of relationships which basically go back to fundamental human nature and have their, you go back to the South Sea bubble. They all have these various characteristics. And I think 2008 actually was a major statistical input because we never had before seen financial markets, especially short-term financial markets, literally freeze up the way they did in 2008.
Adrian just wants to come in.
One of the things that struck me watching this from very much from the outside was simply the power of politics during this, in the sense that both the Democrats and the Republicans, for different reasons, wanted to increase the number of Americans who had homes. The Democrats said, you know, let's have lots of poor people getting homes. And the Republicans, particularly George W. Bush, says, let's have a home-owning democracy. That'll be good for Republican virtues. So you've got huge political pressure on people to borrow money, to get into the property market. Was that a big factor at this time through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the mortgage finance industry based in Washington?
Indeed. I spent a good deal of my time both as chairman of the Fed and as a private citizen complaining that these two institutions were government-subsidized producers of toxic assets.
There's a lot there that we could unpack about what's been learned and where blame might have lain in the past, but where do you think the next bubble or financial crisis is most likely to come from? Dr. Greenspan, your ghosts of irrational exuberance, do you sometimes feel them around you today?
No, actually, I don't think this economy is as buoyant as a number of people do. I measure it by the rate of growth and productivity, not by the employment rate, not by inflation as such. But fundamental is output per hour. Output per hour in the last 8 or 9 years has been at a subnormal rate of increase, as indeed the whole world has been. In Britain, Brexit is a wonderful example of what happens to a market economy when its rate of growth slows down beneath a certain threshold. And I think what engendered Brexit and what is engendering the emergence of Donald Trump in the United States are two major economies slowing significantly below their potential rate of growth. And for example, in the last 6 months or 6 years, depending how you want to look at it, our productivity growth rate has been under 1% a year. So is that in the UK. We both used to be 3% or thereabouts. And that is a huge difference in the type, the level of the economy. And you get people coming in, as indeed the Brazilian election is showing very much that similar type of pattern, where Brazil was an extraordinarily potent economy and it collapsed under very dubious political control.
Can I just throw this back to Adrian Wooldridge, who's covering Britain and Brexit and the road to Brexit a lot? Do you entirely identify with that, that you can sort of make a direct correlation between the lower rates of productivity growth and populism?
Absolutely. I think that basically what you have is an economy now where everybody's competing for a fairly fixed pie. And so that sets interest groups against each other. Instead of looking to get richer and better, they're looking to get a bigger share of a fixed pie. And I think also there's a sort of a weird thing that's going on as well, which is that we have a combination of a very high degree of economic turbulence. There's a lot of change, a lot of churn, a lot of technological innovation, but there's no really serious overall productivity growth. So everybody will happily move house or move job if they're moving to a bigger house or a better job. Now they've been asked to move to the same sort of house or the same sort of job, but they're getting all the churn with none of the benefits. And I think that's a terrible mixture.
So what would we learn from the history that you two have written together about populism? You discuss populism and its economic environment in the late 19th century, what would we learn about contending with the populism in Donald Trump's America or other forms in Europe today?
Yeah, I think we're moving towards what we call stagflation. That is, it's very difficult to have this huge fiscal deficit because, remember, one of the real problems with respect to entitlements...
I'm going to be Mrs. Normal, Adrian, and say, just explain entitlements in this context for us, please, those of us who didn't study economics. Oh, Dr. Greenspan.
In the international arena, it's called social benefits. It's various pension funds set up by government as welfare programs to take care of various aspects of the population. In the United States, we have an old age and survivors fund, we have Medicare, we have Medicaid, and we have a variety of other things which individuals, by their very nature of being a citizen of the United States and having certain other characteristics, are entitled to government payments of a certain dimension. If they were fully funded, which they were in the beginning and were supposed to be, then they would not have that negative effect on the economy. But they're not. And the huge deficit, which is scheduled, if you listen to the Congressional Budget Office in the United States, the debt is scheduled to go up to tremendously high levels in the years immediately ahead.
That sounds a bit miserable, Adrian.
Well, I think America's got to do two things to deal with the populism problem. First of all, it's got to get its growth back. It's put its rate of productivity growth back up. And I think tackling the entitlement problem is absolutely fundamental to that because it's shifting money away from productive investment to less productive use. And we have to make sure that there's no future financial crisis. And I think there are ways of reducing the likelihood of financial crisis by forcing banks to keep more cash in reserves.
More equity cash in reserves.
Are you equally convinced, Dr. Greenspan, that we're not risking another financial crisis right now?
As Adrian points out, if we were to go to, for example, globally, the average rate of equity capital in commercial banks or financial intermediaries is historically low, but far more important, we would solve all of the issues of contagious default, which is a necessary condition for the 2008-1929 type of crises. And if you have an ability to prevent contagious default, and the one way you do it is to look and ask yourself, where in a free and a market economy is there no significant type of default feeding on one another? And that is in the so-called non-financial sector of the economy, where the capital stock, equity to assets, is 40%, some in many cases much larger than that. Commercial banks have 11 to 15%. And the chances of a contagious series of defaults in the first case, where you have very large capital buffers, is very low to non-existent, where it's very high and very troublesome. And one of the things that we put in the book is to explain how we can have a system partly reflecting the Greek, the Swedish experience and what we see in the developed world generally, how to solve this problem by doing a simple thing, sharply raising the capital requirements. And what the data show us going all the way back to 1869 is that there is no relationship between the amount of capital you have relative to assets and return on equity. That means that the people who argue that they will, that going to this very substantial change would induce a major problem, are just mistaken. The data do not show that. And the reason is that the rate of return on equity capital is a built-in issue of human time preference. and that does not vary and would not vary irrespective of how much capital we require of financial intermediaries.
See, this is essentially an extremely optimistic book about American capitalism, because there are some people who say that America will just cease to be an exceptional nation, that its rate of growth will slow down because it's an advanced economy. And there are other people who say that it's the nature of modern technology, that it just doesn't generate the sort of growth that we've seen in the past. We don't think that's the case. We think there's an extraordinary technological revolution going on. There's an extraordinary power in the American economy to generate really high levels of growth. But it's been slowing down partly because of a poorly run financial system, which generated a crisis of important proportions in 2008, and partly because of a very badly run entitlement system, which means America is spending more on entitlements really than it's funding. So that fuels the deficit. But if you could solve those two policy problems, the underlying economy, the economy that you see these great companies like Google and Amazon and the rest of it, is a very powerful one. So America could reclaim its dynamism. And that's very important, because do we want the 21st century to be defined by an authoritarian society like China or a liberal society like the United States? So a lot depends on solving these policy problems.
I'm pleased you brought that up, Adrian. As we come to a close, I must throw to both of you the question of whether there can be more than one winner, really, as we look forward. Is China going to challenge this optimistic reading that you seem to both share, warts and all, about the American economy?
Well, if you go back in Chinese history, Deng Xiaoping essentially reversed Mao Zedong's basic communist system, which existed after World War II. And we had a whole series progressively of increasingly more liberal governments within China. And I remember very distinctly, I had to work with Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji in the 1990s. And their basic disclosed view, one being the president, the other being the prime minister, their view is, how do we make Chinese economy to function like the American? Now, with Xi in power now, perhaps semi-permanently, this is not the vision that Deng Xiaoping had. But I would say, if it weren't for this major problem, China would be a very successful a market economy as it was developing. And I always called it the most capitalist in action for a number of years, until it ran into the last three or four regimes. And I wasn't in government at the time, obviously, and I don't know what happened. And you're not going to find out what's happening within the Politburo unless you're sitting there.
Absolutely. I think that's right. But I do think that I trust America to support the values of liberal democracy around the world. It has done for the last century. So that really, if we can improve the rate of American productivity growth and ensure that the American economy is as dynamic in this century as it was in the last century, that's not just good for America, it's good for the rest of the world, because ultimately America has been the champion of liberal democracy.
Dr. Alan Greenspan and Adrian Wooldridge, thank you both very much. We are on email here, radio@economist.com, or on Twitter at Economist Radio, if you'd like to feed in your thoughts on America as a global economic power and what lies beyond. I'm Anne McElvoy. In London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.